21st, it's Tuesday morning at Akiva Academy. We're learning the weekly Torah portion. This week's portion is a double Torah portion. It's Parshat Acharei Mot and Parshat Kedushim. Because there are Torah portions enough for all the weeks of the year, when we have a leap year, which adds 4 weeks to the Jewish year, therefore when it's not a leap year, there are approximately four, sometimes even five, Parshiot that are extra. How do we read them? We combine them with other parshiot. So this week is a combined parsha of Acharei Mot Kiddushin. We're going to focus on the second of the two parshiot, not on Acharei Mot, but on Kiddushin. And we're going to focus there actually on one verse in that Torah portion. But in order to first focus on that one verse, we want to see the unit that it's part of. So we're going to open up to a unit of about 10 verses in the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, the beginning of Parshat Kedushim. In my edition, which looks like no one has my edition, so I won't tell you what page it's on. The beginning of Parshat Kedushim, chapter 19 of the book of Vayikra, Leviticus. And we're going to read there verses 9 to 18.
Chapter 19?
19, 9 to 18. Everyone have the place? Parsha Kedushim, chapter 19 of Leviticus. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap all the way to the edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall not pick your vineyard bare or gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I, the Lord, am your God. You shall not steal, you shall not deal deceitfully or falsely with one another. You shall not swear falsely by my name, profaning the name of your God, I am the Lord. You shall not defraud your fellow, you shall not commit robbery. The wages of a laborer shall not remain with you until morning, but pay him when he finishes the day. You shall not insult the deaf or place a stumbling block before the blind. You shall fear your God, I am the Lord. You shall not render an unfair decision. Do not favor the poor. Show deference to the rich. Judge your kinsmen favorably. Or fairly, I'm sorry. I made a mistake there. Judge your kinsmen fairly. Do not deal basely with your countrymen. Do not profit by the blood of your fellow. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your kinsfolk in your heart. Reprove your kinsfolk, but incur no guilt because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against your countrymen. Love your fellows yourself. I am the Lord. Now, even though I'm sure there were many verses I just read, they're not completely clear what they mean, still, I think the overall tenor and theme of these verses is clear, despite the difficulties with the English translations. So I'm just going to ask the question, what is the theme? What holds all these verses together? What's their common denominator?
Morality,
right? Morality, ethics. In Hebrew, we say these are mitzvot ben adam lechavero, mitzvot between man and man, as opposed to mitzvot between man and God, as opposed to mitzvot ben adam lemakom. These are mitzvot ben adam lechavero, and they all seem to be what we call morality, ethics, menschlichkeit. Say it again.
It's law.
It's law, but it's law of the type of thing that human beings would come to on their own. It might be a higher standard than what you would see in law codes. It's more of what you would consider to be upright morality between people who try to hold themselves to the higher standards. Now, given that we're talking about morality, ethics, bein adam lechaverot, clearly the subjects and the objects here, the people we're talking about, are all of us. In the classroom, in the home, in the field, in business, it's about all human beings as they are. Except that there's one verse here among the verses I read that doesn't completely fit in. Because this one doesn't seem to be talking about morality and ethics, and this one doesn't seem to be talking to the common man as he is where he is. Does anyone notice which verse it is that really sticks out like a sore thumb?
Verse 9.
Say it again?
Verse 9.
I'm going to look at verse 9. No, verse 9 is about leaving for the poor and the stranger. That's social justice.
Yeah. Do not favor the poor.
Ah, do not favor the poor.
The rich.
And it also says, do not favor the rich. Let's look at that verse again. That was verse 15. Right? You shall not render an unfair decision. Do not favor the poor or show deference to the rich. Judge your kinsmen fairly. So, who is this verse talking to?
The judge.
Judges. It's talking to the judges. And the context is in the courtroom. Which really means it's not talking like all the other verses are talking about relationships between peers, but relationships between someone who's sitting as a judge and someone who's sitting as a defendant.
Is there a concept of a jury in these days?
No.
Okay, just judging.
But there certainly could be a concept of a panel of judges. Right, three judges or 21 judges or 71.
Those are learned, those are
yes.
appointed,
yeah.
not your average.
Right. There's no jury. So what I'm trying to say is that verse 15 doesn't fit the context. And the reason, again, that I'm saying it doesn't fit is because all the other verses are talking about peer relations and they're talking about normal, everyday ethics and morality. Verse 15, on the other hand, is talking, it seems, in a courtroom situation of a judge and a judged. And it's not morality, it's justice. Judge your kinsman fairly, which means according to the letter of the law. Do what has to be done according to the law and don't play favorites, neither towards the poor because you think they need a break, nor towards the rich because they have influence. No, have to judge according to the letter of the law. And that's fairly. Yeah. Now this verse is what we're going to focus on for the next hour. This verse 15. Now, not only does the verse seem out of place in context, but there's also an inner, internal issue with the verse, which is that it seems to be superfluous. Part of it seems to be superfluous. Because you've already said at the beginning, you shall not render an unfair decision, then it seems rather unnecessary to say at the end, judge your kinsman fairly. You already said, do not judge unfairly, so why do you have to tell me judge fairly?
And also there is an issue, a grammatical issue. It starts talking to you in the plural, and then it starts talking to you as a single.
Wow! Goodness gracious, thank you! I didn't even notice that. And that fits exactly what I'm going to say.
Oh, good.
Oh, my pen. I lost all my pen. Very good point. Okay. So there's going to be four reasons, four difficulties with this verse. So number one, we said it doesn't fit into the context. Number two, the end of the verse seems to be superfluous. Number three, the end of the verse in Hebrew is in the singular, whereas the beginning is in the plural. Look at the verses I printed in Hebrew on the sheet, letter D. It begins, Lo ta'asu avel. Do not do unfairness b'mishpat, in judgment, and that word do not do is in the plural. Lo tasu, y'all do not do. Whereas the very end of the verse, the last three words say b'tzedek tishpot amitecha.
And also lo tehedar is in single.
Okay, that's not going to fit into what I want to say.
Ah, sorry.
Yeah, well, what can we do?
Well, what kind of...
Does not prohibit you from being favorable to your own family.
You're not supposed to be favorable even to your own family.
It does not say that, though.
It says, do not judge unfairly. Okay. But anyway, there's one more point now that I want to highlight, which is that the last word of the verse is amitecha. In Hebrew, amitecha, which means amit shelcha, your peer. Your peer.
Is amit a peer or a friend?
Amit is a peer.
Amit so,
peer.
Yeah.
And the...
Ah, That's very good. That's exactly the problem I want to point out. That if we're talking about a courtroom context, it's not clear why it would say peer. It should have used a different word.
Well, eliminates the being fair to slaves.
Ah, okay.
What did you say?
It eliminates slaves. Not
your peers. You don't have to be fair to slaves. You only have to be fair to yourself.
So what I want to move towards is the following.
Oh.
The rabbis, Chazal, the rabbinic interpretation, has a radically innovative interpretation of the last three words of this verse that says, "B'tzedek tishpot amitecha." And I'm trying to prepare the ground now to understand why the rabbis moved towards a radically different interpretation of the last three words. So it goes like this. The verse is anomalous. We said it doesn't fit into its context. The context is about ethics, and suddenly it's talking about the courtroom. The rabbis take at least the last three words of the verse and put it back into the context. They say the last three words are not talking about the courtroom. They're talking about normal ethics between normal human beings. That's one reason why the rabbis rested, tore the last three words from the rest of the verse, because they're trying to fit as much as possible of this verse into the context that the other verse are talking about, normal human relations. That's point number one. Point number two is that the last word in the verse is amitecha, your peer. That's another reason why the rabbis take the last three words and change them from a courtroom context to a normal, everyday context, because the word is amitecha, your peer. And thirdly, because the verse we said is repetitious inside, internally superfluous, the last three words are, therefore the rabbis say the last three words are talking about something completely different. They're not talking about the courtroom, they're talking about
Everyday
life. And what Ilana said might also be another reason why the rabbis ripped the last three words from the rest of the verse, because they're talking in the singular suddenly as opposed to the beginning. It was talking about the plural.
I have one more proof for you.
Okay.
The word amitecha appears later in verse,
yes, it does.
17.
Yes, and
it kind of proves that that is connected with the everyday.
Yeah, actually I have a whole long thing about that.
Okay.
But we just don't have time to get into it.
Not to spread this whole thing off, why does it have to be a courtroom? Why can't you take the first part of that and assume it's how you deal with people, fairly and unfairly? Why does it have to assume that?
Because it says specifically, lo tasu avel, do not do injustice, bamishpat. Bamishpat means in sitting in judgment. That's mishpat, is judgment.
Okay.
That's what the word mishpat means.
And don't we in our relationships judge people? And don't we do the same thing on a daily, regular basis? We judge people fairly and unfairly in our relationships. And again, it's saying whether they're rich or poor, you need to do it fairly.
And it goes with tishpot.
Wait 2 minutes, and you'll see, as we say in Yiddish, pumpfaker. And it'll fit into what you're saying. The one word of Yiddish I know. It really sounds good.
This is the biggest fall in your education.
So these words, b'tzedek tishpot amitecha, the last three words of the verse, I'm going to present now what the rabbinic tradition says about them. So the rabbis say that the words mean judge your fellow man favorably. Not fairly, but favorably. And to judge your fellow man favorably could very well be the opposite of fairly.
So that's mercy, not
that's
justice.
Mercy. What it comes out to be is the following, and I'll go through a number of steps to explain, that the first 70% of the verse is talking to the judges in the courtroom, to the justices. And it says, you have to judge according to the letter of the law. Do not let concepts of social justice color your judgment. Here's a poor person who doesn't have any money, downtrodden, suffering. You might want to give him a break. No break. Rather, judge with judgment, with justice, according to the letter of the law. Here's our rich person. You think that he deserves a break. He's so important. He helps society so much. He's such a central player. No, letter of the law. So that's the first 60 or 70% of the verse in the courtroom, strict judges, justice. The last three words, the rabbis interpret to mean and explain how they do it, just the opposite. When you're outside of the courtroom, when it's amitet, it's your peer, when it's in the classroom, when it's in business, when it's on the street, when it's in the hospital, wherever it might be, when we're talking about relationships between human beings who are peers, normal, everyday interactions, you're not supposed to judge according to justice. You're not supposed to judge at all. You're supposed to rather give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Look at everyone with rose-colored glasses. If we think in terms of a scale of justice, so when you're in the courtroom, if you're a judge, you have to weigh everything according to justice. Don't give any undue weight to one side, to one person or the other. However, when you're outside in the street or the schoolyard, normal people, always weigh down the pan of your fellow to the side of favor. Always give people the benefit of the doubt. Now, this tension between how we behave in the courtroom and how we behave outside of the courtroom is quite fascinating, but it makes perfect sense. Because in the courtroom, we have to search for the best way to run our country, run our culture, run our people. There has to be justice. Those who did wrong have to be punished. We have to find who the wrongdoers are, otherwise society will come apart from the inside. But when we're outside of the courtroom, there's no need to judge other people. And rather, what you want to do is assume everyone is your friend, everyone is good. Now, of course, there's going to be questions. What happens if it's to my detriment to judge others favorably? For example, it's 3 a.m, knocking on the door. I see through the peephole someone there who has a gun in his hand and blood dripping from his knife. And he says, my car broke down and I want to make a phone call. Can you please let me in? Well, there's a mitzvah to judge others favorably. But wait a second, what about protecting myself? What about when I'm walking through Thanksgiving Square in downtown Dallas and someone comes up to me and asks me for a $10 bill because he has no milk to give his young child. And 5 minutes later, someone else asks me. 5 minutes later, someone else asks me. I begin to suspect, wait a second, perhaps something going on here. Do I judge favorably and give them money, or do I kind of protect myself so I leave something in my wallet? So there are cases in which there are conflicts between judging others favorably on the one hand and simply protecting yourself on the other hand. And the halakha has a way of dealing with those tensions. Perhaps I'll just say on one foot that one of the most, I think, insightful halachic commentaries is that you can do both at once. You can judge favorably and still protect yourself. When that person knocks on your door 3 a.m, you can really say to yourself, I know that most people are probably honest, and there's a good chance that he's coming just because he really needs to make a phone call. But I have to protect myself, so I trust you, but you know, just to be careful, I'm not going to open the door. The same thing with people asking for money in downtown Dallas. You have to develop an attitude of trust and of love at the same time that you also are realistic and defend yourself. And it's possible to live with both in your consciousness at the same time. But that's not going to be a subject for today. It's not our subject for today because there are just so many instances in life in which there is no conflict, no tension between judging others favorably and protecting yourself. So many aspects of life, and we'll go into many stories in another few minutes, we just have to condition ourselves and train ourselves, and I'll explain why and how, to judge favorably. But before we get to that, the big question that everyone should be asking themselves and chopping on the bit and really getting here nervous and impatient is the following. How in the world could the rabbis take those last three words of the verse, which are translated in my translation as judge your kinsman fairly, and claim they mean the opposite? How can the rabbis claim that they mean judge favorably when it seems to say judge fairly? And I want to spend now 5 minutes explaining how the rabbis took those three words, bitzedek, tishpot, amitecha, and interpreted them differently. So you see those three words?
Yes.
I'm looking in the Hebrew on my sheet. Bitzedek, tishpot, amitecha. So what does it mean, bitzedek? It means with tzedek, with justice. Tishpot, judge. Amitecha, your peer. How did they turn that from justice to mercy? How did they turn it from justice to favorably? So I'm going to tell you how. And I'm going to actually draw it on the board. So, the following. We all know that traditionally, the Jewish people passed down Torah from generation to generation through the text of the Sefer Torah, the text of the Torah scroll. And we also know that the Torah scroll is written with consonant but without vowels. And then when words are written with consonant but without vowels, they can be pronounced and therefore interpreted in radically different fashions. Like just to give you we'll see examples as we go on. So how do I know that these three words, bitzedek, tishpot, amitecha, are to be enunciated, pronounced as tzedek, tishpot, amitecha? How do we know they're not to be pronounced differently? The answer is from Fiddler on the Roof.
Tradition.
In other words, the Jewish people passed down the written Torah without vowels, but we also passed down the tradition of how to pronounce the words. If there was no such tradition, then the consonants would be meaningless. They would have no pronunciation and no meaning. So there's a tradition that when the word is written X, it's pronounced in a certain fashion. That the word Moshe is not pronounced Moshu, and not Moshe, but rather Moshe, and not me, Sho, but it's pronounced Moshe. How do I know? The consonants don't tell me what vowels are, but it, tradition tells me. The same thing with our verse here, with Tzedek, Tishpot, Amitecha. How do I know that's the way to say it, and that's the way to interpret it? That it means, but Tzedek, with justice, judge your fellow? Because that's a tradition of pronouncing it, passed down from generation to generation. However, since the vowels, the pronunciation is not written in the Sefer Torah, therefore, the rabbis give permission in certain cases to interpret the consonants in a fashion that is at odds with the oral tradition of how to pronounce it. And that's what's happening in our case. So I put on the board. Can you see this?
Yes.
Vaguely.
Vaguely. Let me use black. Bitzedek tishpot amitecha. The last three words of the verse. And as I just pronounced them, as the vowel vocalization appears in our print chumashim, it's bitzedek tishpot amitecha, with justice judge your fellow. However, like we said, we have at least three, if not four, reasons to try and do something more creative with these words. So the rabbis apparently took this word, bitzedek, and reinterpreted it radically. So just think now, for those of you who know some Hebrew, how can I take the word bitzedek, with justice, and change a little bit the vowels and come to something radically different?
Tziduk.
Right? You can say bid si and siduk. Oh, let me do it like this. You can say bid siduk, with justification, judge your fellow. The same consonants come to the opposite meaning. Not with justice, but with justification. It's always find a way to justify your fellow. Or I can take the same bit sedek and interpret it as bit sadiq.
That's what I'm trying to have with.
Bit sadiq. As a righteous person, judge your fellow. Always judge him to be righteous. Or I can try one more time.
Bit tzedaka.
Yes. I can write bitstaka, with charity, judge your fellow.
Bitstaka.
So the rabbis didn't tell us which of these three options they chose, but apparently they chose one of these three because they wrote in the Talmud, in
Masechet Shavuot, and also in Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, that what this verse means is that you should judge others favorably.
Well,
and this is one of the 613 mitzvot, according to many of the early authorities in the Middle Ages, that you're always supposed to judge others favorably and give them the benefit of the doubt when you're not in the courtroom. Well, if you're a judge in the courtroom, completely different rules apply.
Yeah, but it does apply in the courtroom during the punishment phase. They can rule that he's guilty, but due to the circumstances, his punishment should be lighter.
Well, there's no punishment phase in Jewish law because the Torah says what the punishment is. So anyway, so I find this rather fascinating. And the truth is that this is one of my most favorite mitzvot. And why is it one of my favorite mitzvot? Perhaps because its power for affecting and molding and improving human life is so clear and so visceral. What I want to do at this point is explain what I mean by that. And I have five different options on the sheet where in D3, the human benefits of judging others favorably. And we're just talking about walking around town and going through life and trying as much as possible to give a favorable spin to the events around you, whether it's when someone talks to you angrily, or the plumber charges $150 for a house visit, or when your daughter's teacher gives her a D on her report, or when the music teacher says that this child can't sing. Try and give everything a favorable spin. Why? Well, here are five different explanations of the positive beneficial effects. Rashi, in his commentary on the Talmud in Tractate Shabbat, explicates what the Talmud is saying there. And what it says is that this is a way of creating peace between human beings, of creating an atmosphere of trust and of peace and of harmony, as opposed to an atmosphere of distrust and suspicion and conflict. And when you have less conflict and more harmony, life is simply better. Life is
except
more positive.
Sometimes it can hit you in the face.
In the sense of opening yourself up to possible exploitation. That's what I mentioned earlier, that there is sometimes that issue and has to be dealt with, but many times there isn't that issue. But many times there isn't. Although sometimes we fool ourselves into thinking there is. But there's a lot of cases in which judging favorably can have no downside and many upsides, except that it's hard. It's hard to get into the habit. It's hard to allow yourself to be so charitable towards people you'd rather just have a churning distrust of within your heart. But that doesn't do you any good in the end.
But the question I have about that is this. Isn't there a prohibition against altering what the Torah says? What you said was basically a very, very clever way of shaping the Torah to say what you want it to say so that you can do what you want to do. And the rabbis allow it, so I guess it's perfectly acceptable. But how does that jive with the prohibition against altering the Torah?
It doesn't alter the Torah.
So it says in Deuteronomy two places, do not add to it or subtract.
Sure it does.
Yeah, it doesn't.
And so it's saying perhaps we have here a case of subtracting and adding. Indeed, the rabbis understood not to change any letters of the Torah. But here they're not changing the letters of the Torah.
They're simply tweaking it.
That's the human side of interpretation. Because we saw that the rabbis didn't do this for no reason. They really felt the verse didn't make sense. There are anomalies in the verse. And part of their understanding of interpretation is a responsibility to make it make sense. And indeed, you're right that Jewish tradition takes many, many liberties in making the Torah make sense and make it relevant. And that's what's called Torah Sheba'al Peh. That's the oral law that has the Torah always developing and responding to the needs of the people in that century and in that time. Yeah, it's a big issue. You're right. It's not to be dealt with in 1 minute, which I just did. It's a big issue, but we can't deal with it now.
But it's not done lightly.
For certain. Mm. For certain.
Just often.
I have to just...
just often. Often. It's an often instead of a lightly.
Okay.
I just have to say this. Yesterday, I'm part of a study about aging such, and so I had to take an assessment test with like 500 questions and strongly agree, strongly disagree, and in between. And one of them was, I prefer, or something, mercy over justice. And why do I remember that one? And I can't remember the other 499. Mm-hmm. And I said, strongly agree.
Good for you.
You learned something.
I mean, look.
It was a preparation for our class today. The Meiri, I'm in the same place on the sheet in D3B. Rabbeinu HaMeiri, Menachem HaMeiri, is in Provence in the 12th and 13th centuries. And he gives us another reason. I don't have a source here to read. I'll just tell you orally why judging favorably is so powerful a tool for improving one's life. And he says the following, that vis-a-vis teachers and leaders, there's very often a tendency for people to find fault. Think of political leaders. And think also of kids in college and in high school, how they relate to their teachers. There's a tendency to find fault among those who are above you, or your leaders, your teachers, your political guides. The Meiri points out that when you find fault and you criticize those you're supposed to be learning from, then you open the door to closing yourself off from their message. Because you say, I don't have to learn from them, I don't have to accept their admonishments, their rebuke, their leadership, because they don't know any better than I do. And what you actually do at that point is you close yourself off from the possibility of further human growth and learning from other people. Whereas judging favorably allows you to see what you can learn from everyone around you, including political leaders and teachers. So it really, for the Meiri, is a step towards human expansion, human growth, human development, human learning, judging favorably. A third point about judging favorably and its efficacy and its benefits is the Sefer Mitzvot HaKatan. We're going to turn over the page. Here I quoted from what he wrote, Rabbi Yitzhak ben Yosef of Corvey in France, 13th century. When one will judge others favorably, he will think to himself that there are no transgressors other than himself. And he will repent before his Creator, lest he weigh all the world down with his guilt. So the language here is rather stark and harsh, but what he's saying is that most of us, and this is usually unconscious, we try to be, or we want to be, or we tend to be, more or less like other people. You don't want to stand out too much. You don't want to be too different, not for good and not for bad. And again, sometimes this is conscious. Most of the time it's unconscious. We mold ourselves to our surroundings. As far as our opinions go, as far as our dress goes, as far as the standards of our behavior. If you're certain that everyone else is sinning, you have more of a tendency to do it yourself. If you judge others favorably, then unconsciously the standard of human behavior around you is that much higher, and unconsciously you'll feel that you have to live up to it. A very good example has to do with one's understanding of how his peers and his neighbors and his fellow co-workers fill out their income tax returns. pretty sure that most people fudge it here and there, then you have a tendency, unconsciously, of course, to do the same. But if you're pretty certain that most of the people you know are scrupulously honest in their U.S. income tax return, then you feel you have no choice but to do the same, because you just don't want to be too different. And this happens in so many different areas of life. So that the more you judge others favorably, the more the standards for your own behavior are that much stricter and that much more ethical.
But it's be the other way too. We have like Doch ish tzadik tamim haya bedorotav. So he's in a generation that is all evil. If he judged them favorably, he wouldn't have been so good.
No, but if he would judge them favorably, then he would assume that they're doing good, and he would like them.
Oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm. But then the problem with that is when you have a society where you see that they're doing, but everybody's doing the wrong thing, like we did in this country through the out-and-out segregation over the years. And if you view everybody favorably instead of fairly, you're excusing them for what they're doing. That's a problem with this.
That's good. That's yes. A good question.
And you know, that's the problem with this issue is if you view everybody favorably, you tend to
remove critical things.
Now when you take them to court.
What?
Now when you take them to court.
This isn't saying you take it to court, though, if you say favorably.
Right. This is just dealing with people, but once the issue gets to court, then you deal with them in a just manner.
Yeah, but it removes critical thinking, doesn't it?
Yeah,
okay, good points, good points.
You know, all the prophets wouldn't have existed, would they have judged their fellows favorably.
So this gets into what we're going to move to right away, what it means, and what are the techniques of judging favorably. Think for a second here. Let me just give an example. It has to do again with what Roy brought up earlier about protecting yourself. And I brought in that context, I brought up the dichotomy, distinction, that you can both protect yourself and judge favorably at the same time. Let me give an example. I was mugged. I'm asked to give testimony to the police officer, and later I'm asked to testify at the trial of the person who mugged me. My claim would be that you can both to judge the person favorably and give the most honest and scathing testimony to the officer and to the court. And these two things are not contradictory. Justice has to be done, and justice should be done, and it's good for everyone that justice is done. At the same time, I can judge that person who mugged me favorably. What does it mean, favorably? Well, I can't say to myself, he didn't do it, because I saw him do it. But I can understand that there might have been extenuating circumstances, he might have been under some type of psychological duress, he might have had a difficult childhood, etc., etc., etc. We'll get to the techniques in another few minutes. But I want to try and hold in my consciousness two aspects at the same time. Justice has to be done in the courtroom, but in my own personal understanding of this person as a human being, I can be charitable. And there shouldn't be any contradiction between them. I'm not saying it's always easy to hold both ends of the stick at the same time, but it's possible. And again, we'll get to those techniques in another few minutes. I want to move on to D on the sheet here. We're in again D, 3D. And I'm going to tell here a story that I find just so instructive. I heard this story from Rabbi Ed Feinstein, who many, many years ago, I think two decades ago, was the rabbi of Sherith Israel. He came back to Dallas about 5 years ago for an evening lecture brought by his former congregants, who still greatly admire him. And I was just blown away by the story. He didn't tell it in the context of judging favorably, but it fits 100% into this context. So listen to this. There was once a middle-aged guy who lived in a quaint little town someplace in the foothills of X City. And he came to the conclusion that he's had enough with life. Just doesn't like his work. It's always a drudgery. And you know, his kids are always yelling and screaming, and he can't educate them. And his wife is always cross with him, and the bed is always lumpy, and the soup is always cold. Light is just not going anywhere. And he's had this day in, day out for years, it seems. There's no way out. So he says to God, I want to go to paradise now. I've had it. I just can't take this life even one more day. And God says to him, are you sure you understand the meaning of what you're asking? And he says, yeah, I understand completely. No more of this life. I want out of here. No more family. No more living in this town. I want to go to heaven. I want to go to paradise. And God says, look, if you're certain that's what you want, and you've weighed the options, and you're sure there's nothing for you in this world, I'll send you to paradise. Tomorrow morning, get up bright and early, walk 50 miles due north, you'll find yourself in paradise. The guy's very happy, wakes up the next morning, laces his shoes, puts on his jacket, has his breakfast, and without telling anyone, he starts walking 50 miles due south. Now, it's a beautiful day.
North.
Due north, excuse me. Thank you for correcting me. What a mistake there.
The south goes down to
heaven. So he's walking 50 miles due north, and it's a beautiful day. The sun is shining, the birds are chirping. He's walking on a country path with the trees on both sides, and it's green, it's spring. The brook is gurgling on the side of the road, and he's just in seventh heaven because he's on his way to paradise, and God has granted him his wish. It really couldn't be a better feeling to know that you're going right now to paradise. And as the sun starts going down, he realizes he's made very good time. He's probably halfway there, already 25 miles, but he's not going to make it in one day. He'll go to sleep at the side of the road, and the next day he'll continue on. So he finds a nice glen on the side of the road where there's a beautiful tree and there's the brook and there's figs growing from the tree. He can have something to eat. He drinks from the brook and he's lying down in a bed of grass for a very, very restful night's sleep. And just before he falls asleep, he gets up with a start. Wait a second. I want to go due north, right? But I've never been there before. How am I going to be certain tomorrow morning that I'll know which way to go? So he takes his shoes that he just took off and he points them on the side of the road in the direction of north. When he wakes up, he'll know where he's going. And indeed, he has a wonderful night's sleep. He couldn't be happier. He's on his way to paradise. And he wakes up in the morning, puts on his shoes, and then something happened. Now, some say it was an angel that did it, some say a squirrel, some say the guy just got confused himself, but he puts on his shoes and he starts walking after breakfast in the wrong direction. And he has no idea. And it's a beautiful day. The birds are chirping. The sun is shining. There's a nice breeze behind him, pushing him forward. Nothing could be better, because he's on his way to paradise. Such an enjoyable walk he has. And as the sun starts going down, he sees paradise in the distance. And it's this little town in the foothills. There's a low cloud covering part of the town. It looks just, wow! It's just so enticing. It's so beautiful. And he quickens his step on his way to paradise. He walks a little bit up the mountain. He gets into the square of this town. And what a beautiful town. He's never seen such a beautiful place. He sits down on a park bench, and someone walks by him and says, how are you today? And he responds, I'm great. And he says to himself, wow, in paradise, they say hello to you. It should only have been this nice back home. He's sitting on the bench and he's looking around. He smells this beautiful smell from the bakery. What wonderful smells they have in paradise. Wow. Someone walks by and says, Mr. So-and-so, you look great today. And he says to himself, wow, in paradise, they know your name. That's like unbelievable. And he starts to notice that here in paradise, it looks vaguely familiar. I've seen a place like this before. And he says to himself, I guess in paradise, they just want to make you feel so much at home, and it's so familiar. So he's wondering now, what is he going to do? Where do you spend the night in paradise? Is there night at all? But indeed, it's getting dark. So he starts walking around, and he looks at the street signs, and he recognizes some of the names. This street sounds familiar. And then he has a really, bizarre thought. He wonders, I recognize this street, and I recognize this street. I wonder if I walk in this direction, I wonder if I'll come to the street that I used to live on, back home. And indeed, he sees a street sign, the exact same name that he lived on at home. And then he really feels kind of strange because all the houses look familiar. And he wonders if he counts five houses up, if he'll come to a house that looks just like the one he used to live in. And indeed, he comes to this house. It looks just like the one he used to live in. But the paint is much nicer and the grass, of course, is trimmed. And everything is just so beautiful, as it should be, in paradise. He's standing outside, wondering if he should go into this house. And then a woman who looks just so much like his wife comes out and she says, "Where have you been? Your soup's getting cold." So he walks in and he has this piping hot bowl of soup waiting for him on the table. And this soup has the taste of paradise. He's never tasted soup that's just so good and so refreshing and so satisfying. So he drinks this bowl of soup and he says to the woman, "That soup was delicious." And then she says the craziest thing. She says, "You've never said that before." And she starts beaming and smiling, and he smiles back at her. "This is just a great place, this paradise." And then he says the following to her. He says, "Am I allowed? Do you think you'd be able to give me another bowl of soup?" And she says, "Of course I'll give you another bowl of soup." And he gets another bowl of soup, and it's just so good, and it's so delicious, and it's satisfying, it's hot. He has this wonderful bowl of soup and he says to the woman, "That was the greatest soup I have ever tasted. That's the soup of paradise," he says to her. And she starts beaming at this smile from ear to ear, and she bends over and gives him a big kiss on the cheek. And he's in seventh heaven. And he says, "Exactly as I pictured paradise, that's what it's like." And then he hears the voices of children in the next room. They sound very similar to his own kids, but so much better behaved, and they're not screaming at each other, and they're playing so nicely. He walks into the den, and he sits down with them, and he starts playing, and has so much fun. And then the kids say one word that really confuses him, but it fits into everything that's been happening. They say to him, "Daddy." And wow, in paradise, the kids call you father. Wow, that's really something. They really make you feel at home. And he plays with the kids. And he's having such a good time until he decides he just has to go to sleep. And he wonders if this house has a bed just like his bed at home. And he knows even if it does have a bed, it's going to be the biggest, most luxurious, softest, most comfortable bed he's ever slept in. You know what? He goes up to the bed and it's just fantastic. And it's all, the bed is made so beautifully. He gets into the bed, falls asleep, and he sleeps the sleep of a man in paradise. What a wonderful night he has. And he wakes up so refreshed and so happy. And he wonders, okay, now I'm in paradise for the day. What do they do here? He smells something brewing downstairs. He goes down and there's this delicious mug of coffee waiting for him. He's never tasted. It's like the taste of paradise. He has this mug of coffee. And then that woman looks just like his wife. She walks up to him with this belt of tools. And she says, "Here's your tools. Have a very nice day at work." He says to himself, "Wait a second, in paradise you have to work?" "I guess you do, I'll go to work." But he says to himself, "I'm certain that this work is going to be so fulfilling and so meaningful, and the time's just going to pass like paradise." And that's what happens. He goes to work, and it's just a fantastic day he has there. He comes back from work, and his soup is waiting for him, and he lives happily ever after
in paradise.
Well, that's the variation. He lives in his house, very small, tight, and everything. And he says, "Bring it." And then he goes to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe says, "If you feel it's so small, so terrible, so crowded, what can have a big?"
But this story is a little bit different because it's not about any physical change.
Bring in the cow, bring in the sheep.
Yeah, that was my grandmother's rabbi, the rabbi from Jacob.
Your time is getting very short, unfortunately. But this story, for me, is the fourth explanation of the benefits of positive thinking, of positive judgment, of looking at the world favorably, judging other people, giving them the benefit of the doubt. Because to a large degree, the world we live in is subjective. It's what we see, it's the glasses we wear, it's what we make of it. And we can control the world we live, the reality that we find ourselves in. Our environment is a function of how we understand it. And perhaps I'll say that 80% is a function of how we understand it, and you'll say only 60%, so we'll have an argument. But even if it's only 60%, even if it's only 40%, is based on the glasses you put on, 40% is an awful lot. This idea that the world is subjective, and it depends on how you decide to see it, understand, interpret it, is taken by the Mei HaShiloach, the Hasidic author we've seen perhaps once or twice, to the nth degree, and this is E on the sheet, when he says the following, it's an unbelievable statement. The Mei HaShiloach claims, he seems to say, that the difference, it's not printed for you as far as his words, just here in D3E, I wrote the Mei HaShiloach. The Mei HaShiloach claims that the difference between this era and the Messianic era is only in perspective. It's the same world. The miracle of the Messianic age is that God will give us positive perspective. Just think about this. The same world, but different perspective. Now, if he means it literally, I don't know, but the idea is so powerful that what has to be changed to make this world messianic is primarily in your mind, which means that we have the power to bring the messianic age right now through self-instruction and self-development. So it's not just that it can bring peace between people, not just to open yourself to other people's teachings, not just an impetus to self-judgment, self-improvement, not just engendering personal happiness, but according to the Mei HaShiloach, judging others favorably and judging the world favorably can even change the world. So, after convincing you that here is the key to personal happiness, and I'm really convinced this is one of the keys to personal happiness, it's kind of belittling to reduce it to an hour class, but that's what we have to do. What I want to do in the last 10 minutes is to make this very, very practical, because I understand that very often I don't make things practical, and we leave them level of philosophy, because I really prefer, in a certain sense, the level of philosophy. But after studying this mitzvah for about 20 years, I've collected 6 different techniques that you can use in a very practical, brass tacks fashion to put this into practice. And I listed them at the bottom of the sheet, 6 techniques for judging favorably. The first technique, and the second and the third, actually comes from Rashi's commentary on the Talmud. We're going to turn over the sheet and look at the second passage there, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, that's Rashi in his commentary on the Torah, in judging the other favorably and saying to oneself, he did me no wrong in this, or he was under duress, or his intentions were for the best, peace is established between them. What Rashi just did is give us 3 different techniques for judging favorably, and I think he gave them in the order they should be applied. Your first try, he did me no wrong. If that doesn't work, you try, he was under duress. If that doesn't work, you try, his intentions were for the best. And I want to give just some examples of how these 3 techniques might work. When we say, he did me no wrong in this, that's when you look at reality and you say, perhaps what I thought the person did wrong, they just didn't do. I just didn't see, I didn't understand. And the example I'm going to give is from television in the late 1950s and early 60s. I don't know if anyone in this room was around then. Probably not. Right? And the reason I'm giving
you're very kind.
An example from the 1962 television show Patty Duke is not because I want to date myself, it's just because I haven't seen television since then. But I remember, so we have this middle class family, I think, of Patty Duke. I think she has a sister. She's a teenager, and her parents.
She has a cousin.
A cousin.
Identical cousin.
What show?
Patty Duke was called. So she had a curfew. She had to come back. I don't remember if she had to come home at midnight or 10 o'clock. And at about 3 in the morning, her father wakes up and she sees she's just coming down from the door downstairs up to her bedroom. And he's certain she has broken her curfew. That's what he sees. Now, it's true that she was in her pajamas, but he said to himself, she probably left her pajamas at the front door so that she can get into them right away. She can come up the stairs. And it turns out, though, that Patty Duke had come in on time, met her curfew, but in the middle of the night she woke up and remembered she forgot to turn the light off downstairs. So the reality that her father saw was simply wrong. He could have judged her favorably. And that would be true. And everyone can think of so many different examples. What you thought something was done, you saw something happen, you saw thought someone lied to you, and it's just not so. There's another example I'm going to give, which I have on the sheet here. Yosef the miser. And even though the story is going to take, I'm sorry, it's going to take 8 minutes to tell. And I guess some of you might have to leave in the middle. But I just have to tell this story.
Where are you?
And I'll tell the story. I'll tell the whole story. Rabbi Shlomo Carbach tells the following. He was at this ecumenical convention. It was going on for 3 days. Of Jews and different sects of Christians. They were studying together. They were learning together. They were talking together and eating together. And on the last night of the convention, Rav Shlomo Carbach was there to tell stories and to sing, play his guitar. And the night's getting longer and everyone's involved in song and dance and they're holding hands and sing with him and he's bringing everyone together as he always does. And in the context of his singing and his dancing and his playing the guitar, he tells stories. Always he told stories. And he decided at that night, at kind of the pinnacle of the sense of chavruta, of fellowship and of love, to tell the following story. It's the story of Yosef the miser. It's set in Krakow after World War I, between the two world wars. Now, Yosef was a very, very wealthy, affluent guy. He lived on a hill slightly outside the outskirts of the town of Krakow. And since he was very affluent, those people who were less well-to-do sometimes needed to ask him for a loan, for a gift, for something. And over the years, hundreds of people had asked him for a little bit of help. And the way things developed was always exactly the same. Someone would come to his house after walking out of the city limits, walk up the hill, knock on the door, and he'd be answered by a butler with white gloves and with a hat, a suit, and very, very nicely and politely, the person coming to ask for help would be ushered into the drawing room, would be told to sit down, offered some cake, some cookies, tea, and presently Yosef would come into the room and shake the person's hand. What can I do for you? What do you need? The person would say, well, I'm really sorry. I'm sorry I have to come to you. But, you know, I have these needs and my daughter is sick or I have 4 kids. I have to marry off this daughter of mine. Can you give me some money? And Yosef would take out his notebook and he'd ask many, many questions. How many children do you have and how old are they and what do you think your needs are going to be and how long and how can I help you? What do you need? What day of the week should I give you the money? He'd ask all these questions. And just as it seemed as if everything was going fine and this poor person was really going to get what he needed, well, Yosef would get a little bit hot under the collar and he looks agitated and then his veins start to pop almost and he throws the guy out and says, oh, why should I give you any money? You don't deserve it. Go work for yourself. I'm not giving you a cent. It's my hard-earned money. Money, throws the guy out. And this happened year after year with different people, decade after decade. People kept coming back to Yosef because they said, well, he's such a nice guy and he asked so many questions and he's so interested, he's so solicitous. He must be the guy who went last week and tried to get some money from him. It must be the guy must have touched one of his hot buttons, said the wrong thing. It won't happen to me. But it happened with everyone. Yosef never gave anyone a cent, always threw them out and said, never come back again. So literally 50 years go by and Yosef dies at a ripe old age and everyone hates him. So the Chevra Kadisha, the burial society, refuses to even bury him. They let the body sit a day, 2 days, until the third day the rabbis say, you can't do this to a Jew, you have to bury him. So they bury him, but outside the Jewish cemetery. Because everyone hated him, they could hardly get a minyan for his funeral. After they buried him on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, something happened, not out of the ordinary, but noteworthy. So the rabbi is coming back from synagogue Wednesday afternoon, and there's a knock at his door. and there's a poor person there who's asking for a little bit of help, and the rabbi gives him an envelope of money. And that evening, the same thing happens again. Another person comes asking, and the rabbi says, okay, there are some poor people in the city. You help when you can help. Thursday morning, coming back from davening, there are three people waiting to see the rabbi. And they all say, I need some money. And he doesn't really understand why this week there's so many poor people, but he gives them the money. Friday morning, this is a true story, by the way, at least Rav Shlomo Karbach said it is, Friday morning, there's a line of over 10 people waiting to see him. And the first person asks for some money, and the second asks for some money, and the third asks for some money, until with the fourth person, the rabbi just can't restrain his curiosity. What is happening this week? And he says to this guy, he says, you know, I just don't understand it. You've never come to me before for money. And now you've come, and all these other people have come this week. Well, what's going on here? And the guy says to the rabbi, Rabbi, you're asking me what's going on? I mean, I should be asking you what's going on. I mean, Rabbi, every Friday morning for the past 30 years, you've slipped an envelope of money under my door, exactly what I needed. Suddenly this week you stop and you ask me, Rabbi, what's going on? Yeah, the rabbi says, ah, you're right, I understand. And he doesn't say anything. And he realizes what's been happening for the past 50 years. And he gives a quiet order to the Chevra Kedisha, to the burial society, to exhume the body and put it in the Jewish cemetery, and to put a matzeva, to put a stone that says, here is buried Yosef, the holy miser. And that Shabbat, the rabbi explained to the congregation what had happened all those years. But Shlomo Karbach told this story. Of course, he told it very powerfully, as he always does. And the evening ended, everyone sang and danced together, went back to their rooms, the Christians, the Jews. And at 2 in the morning, Rav Shlomo gets a knock at the door. Who's there? It's Joseph, the bishop. What can I do for you? I need to talk to you, Rabbi. So Rav Shlomo opens the door, gives the guy a hug, as he always did, and they sit down and start talking. The bishop is extremely agitated. It looks like he's had some major life crisis. He can't contain himself. And he tells Rav Shlomo the following story, true story. He says, Rav Shlomo, my whole life I've been trained in Catholicism. I'm now the bishop of the archdiocese. I have a very important position. And 2 weeks ago, my mother died. And she told me on her deathbed, she said, Joseph, there's something I have to tell you. I've kept it from you your whole life in order to protect you. But we're Jewish. We're Jewish family. I'm Jewish. Your father was Jewish. Your grandfather, my mother, were Jews. We didn't want you to know after the Holocaust, but I think as I'm about to leave this world, there's something you have to know. We're Jewish and you were named. She said to him, you were named after Yosef, the holy miser of Krakow, and then she passed away. And the bishop says to Rav Shlomo, I've been beside myself for the past 2 weeks. What am I going to do? Who am I? What's my identity? Am I a Catholic? Should I go back to the Jewish people? And I don't have any basis to make a decision. I'm completely broken and torn. And I came to this event this week hoping to find a sign from God. And your story that you told about my grandfather, that's my sign. Powerful, powerful story. Very meaningful. Actually, my son was once in a plane, which he reenacted. They put this on as a play. But for our purposes, go back to the story. For our purposes, Yosele was judged unfairly and improperly by the whole town for so many years. And we understand why he did it, right? He wanted to give stuck on the highest level, secretly, so no one would know, the center. But it caused everyone to judge him in the harshest possible light, and they could have done better. And that's just an example, just like the Patty Duke show. So the story that sometimes you can try and spin the circumstances to understand things differently. Perhaps the bad thing just wasn't done. He wasn't a miser, and Patty Duke didn't miss her curfew. And there are so many parts of life and so many things that happen that we can interpret differently. So I know that it's really late, and if, again, anyone has to leave, leave. I'm going to give now the 5 other techniques that can be used for judging favorably. So let's say you try your best to spin the circumstance and say the person that I thought did me this evil didn't do it. It doesn't work. And you have to conclude that they are evil, they did miss their curfew, they are a miser, but there's another way now that you can go forward with judging favorably, which is, to use the words of Rashi, the deed was under duress. Words, perhaps they did do the wrong that I thought they did, but they didn't do it of their own free will. They were forced into it on some level. And this happened to me a few years ago. I'm in Jerusalem on a main thoroughfare, stopped at a traffic light, and someone rammed into me from behind. Well, I can't say to myself, the person didn't ram into me. I felt it, and I see the damage. They rammed into me. And I'm extremely angry at them. But I get out of the car, and it turns out that they were actually stopped behind me, and someone rammed into them from behind and pushed their car into mine. That's duress. And so many times in life, someone does hurt you, but they were forced into it. There's physical duress that literally someone took a car and pushed it into my car, as it were, but there's also psychological duress. Someone might have been angry at you because they had a bad argument with their spouse that morning. Now, that wouldn't get them off the hook in a court of law, but it's not a court of law. And I just want to live in a better world, so I'm going to try and judge them favorably and say they usually don't act like that, but this time they were under psychological duress. And if that doesn't work, you can't find any duress, so Rashi says move to a third technique. Mm-hmm. And the third technique is their intentions were for the good. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they did do the act, and perhaps they weren't forced to do it, but they could have had a positive benefit in mind, but it just didn't work. How many times does someone tell a white lie in order to save you from pain, and it ends up boomeranging or backfiring, and it even causes you more pain, but the intentions for the best. And you never know someone's intentions. And it's not just Rashi that gives this third technique, but if you look quickly in the sheet, in Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, Rabbi Judah the Pious, the third entry here, do not judge your fellow negatively, for man sees only outward appearances, while God sees into the heart. And you cannot know what's in a person's mind or heart. Therefore, judge all persons favorably. The third entry. And that's the same thing that Rashi said. You don't know what the person's thinking or intending. You know what they did. You think, at least, you know what they did, but you don't know what they're thinking, and you can suppose to yourself, perhaps their intentions were for the good. And if that doesn't work, there's a fourth technique, and this I brought the name of Rabbi Menachem Meiri here, right in the sheet, going forward, and he says, do not judge your fellow until you find yourself in his place. That's from Ethics of the Fathers, another wording of our principle of judging favorably. That means that if you have seen someone succumb to transgression because he was placed in a very difficult and tempting position, do not judge him unfavorably. Do not write him off as an evil person. Under certain circumstances, there is no way to be sure of resisting temptation. And perhaps even you, were you to find yourself in similar circumstances, you would not be able to control yourself. In other words, I tried to understand that it didn't happen. No, it happened. I tried to understand it was under duress. No, it wasn't under duress. I tried to understand the intentions were positive. It doesn't work. So the fourth possibility is, well, perhaps the person momentarily succumbed to their evil impulse. And had I been in such a position, who knows if I would have been able to resist the temptation. And if I had succumbed, I probably would judge myself favorably. Well, I can't judge the other person favorably. And another commentator, I don't know if they're waiting for the room.
They're waiting for the room now.
Waiting right. For the room?
Yeah.
Okay,
yep.
2 minutes. Okay, so I'll just say that especially in difficult, in high political positions, we tend to judge others favorably, but it could be if you were in that position of influence and of temptation, you wouldn't be able either to resist. And the last two methods, you can look on the board here, on the sheet, perhaps the person did tshuva, he repented. And the last one is, there's a whole person here. You judge them for what you saw them do, but there are so many other aspects to their personality. Look at the whole person.
So
you have to run out of the room.
Does it imply that there is no evil at all?
No, again, because we're always separate.